Okay. Well, thanks very much for having us here, the Out of Science community or some part of it, and I'm honored to give this talk, this overview. In deciding what to do, I have decided to focus mostly on the people who are not from the Out of Science community, although, of course, many of the people in the room are. But to just sort of describe, give an overview of the talk title is called The Quest for Attosecond Pulses. To concentrate mainly on how it is we have gotten to this point where attosecond pulses are made in several laboratories around the world, although perhaps there is no published attosecond measurement from this continent yet. I don't know. Somebody could contradict me there, but I believe not. All right. So this is a European-dominated field with some Asian component, but we expect the U.S. field to take off very soon. So in describing how we got here, this will also, in talking about the challenges that have been overcome in making attosecond pulses in the laboratory and in understanding theoretically how they're produced, that actually will lead nicely into the end of my talk, where I'll discuss what are the challenges and what are the open questions and where are we really going. The take-home message from this talk, actually, as you watch it, is that there's sort of a central irony in attophysics. We have all along said that we wanted to make attosecond pulses because we wanted to study electron dynamics on a sub-femtosecond scale. But it turns out, in order to make the pulses themselves, we had to understand electron dynamics on a sub-femtosecond scale, in a very specific setting, which is strong field physics. But still, it really took an understanding of dynamics on a sub-femtosecond scale before we could have the generation and metrologies that we needed. Okay, so let me start out with a brief introduction where I just want to talk a little bit about time, the history of measuring time and short times. And this is something that Ahmed Zewail in his Nobel Prize symposium in 1999 referred to as the race against time. And he noted that the measurement of time, the duration and the order of events, really qualifies as some of the very first human activity that we can talk about as being science. And so if you go back to 6,000 years to 4,000 BC, the Egyptians had calendars which would tell them when the Nile flooding would recur, something that wasn't obvious from the environment around them when it would start, but with a calendar they could see that. If you jump forward to 1500 BC, they had things like sundials and water clocks. 1300 BC, or AD rather, you start to get mechanical clocks. And we can sort of pick up the story from there and see how it's gone since then. So if we make a plot of time, where this is sort of the year 1600 and here we are roughly in the year 2000. If we're up here measuring a time duration, delta t, of 1 second, this is basically what one could do in the 1700s. One had physiological detectors, what the eye could detect, what the ear could hear. The ear is actually a bit faster than the eye. So, and what happened over the next sort of 300 years is we went down 6 orders of magnitude, especially in the 1800s. This is not drawn exactly right, but especially with the invention of streak photography and things like that, and spark photography. We went down by the beginning of the 1900s to sort of the microsecond level. And what has happened since then, of course, is the invention of the laser. Around 1960. And we've gone down basically another 8 orders of magnitude, getting very close to the femtosecond time scale here. And so we started with this, and over time have gone down. Around 1970, there were picosecond lasers. In the 1980s, there were lasers around 100 femtosecond in duration. And in the 90s, using solid-state lasers, this has been pushed down to the level of about 5 femtoseconds, maybe a little bit less. But I've drawn the line there because this is actually represents something of a hard limit for laser technology.
The so-called
femtosecond barrier. And the point is that this has been broken in recent years, so there's a discontinuity in this line as we now come into the attosecond regime. So we have femtoseconds for 10 to the minus 15. We have attoseconds for 10 to the minus 18. These are both derived from the Swedish roots. Yes?
What's the short for atto?
AS. That's right. But it's from the Scandinavian root for 18, right? Checking with friends. After this, the next thing is zepto. It's 10 to the minus 21, and then yakto. So apparently Harpo lost out. That's
no, Harpo's the next one.
Oh, Harpo's still to come. And 10 to the minus 24 is sort of the decay time of the top quark, so that's maybe the first thing that we could get other people interested in. Well, why do we want to go to this time scale? What's happening here that makes us want to go to this time scale and then break through this barrier? Okay. And, you know, one of the things that you keep hearing is, well, what's the new science? What do you want to do? What are the open questions? And there's sort of an undercurrent to all this of maybe there's nothing. Maybe there's
not so much. Maybe
this is all about making light sources and there's really no science. And one of the things to say about that is, of course, if it were to be the case that a new source of measuring shorter time intervals were to not give us new science, this would be a break with 6,000 years of human history, and that would be pretty interesting. So that's probably not happening, right? And so what are we looking for when we do this? Oh, yes, and the other point is an important barrier has been broken before, which was the picosecond barrier when we came into having femtosecond lasers, and there were certainly many chemists around at the time who said that there's really nothing to be done with femtosecond lasers. No interesting chemistry. There are a few people that still say that, of course, but by and large, there's a huge field in chemical dynamics using femtosecond lasers, so apparently that turned out okay, and this probably will too. So if we think about time scales, if we have over here sort of 1 second and we have attoseconds and femtoseconds over here, and we have and then I've sort of compressed all that up here between about 10 to the minus 3 seconds and 1 second, we have biological processes. These are the things that go on in your body and that you can sense. Down here around nanosecond, you have a lot of surface phenomena. If you go to the picosecond domain and under that, then you get into watching the motion of atoms. So you have the making and breaking of chemical bonds. You have the vibration of the atoms in molecules. And then if you get down below 10 to the 15, you start to get into the time scale of the individual electron motion. And the way to see this is just to think about the sort of orbital period of a Bohr electron, and that orbital period is on the order of attoseconds. It's sort of 1 to 200 attoseconds. So electrons, when they move around in atoms, you can also derive all of these time scales by looking at the characteristic energy differences in the scale, and then these time scales are just 1 over that characteristic distance. And again, looking at that, those characteristic scales for ground states and atoms are sort of 10 electron volts, and that again gets you back to the attosecond time scale. So There's another thing going on at this discontinuity here, which is you're crossing another threshold, all right? And that is actually with the wavelength of the light. These are all laser sources, all right? All of these. They're actual lasers. They have the temporal and spatial coherence of lasers there. They are based on gain media. And they all operate at wavelengths that are shorter than, what's the longest wavelength laser? Maybe 150 nanometers, something like that? The shortest wavelength laser, I'm sorry. Sorry. The shortest wavelength laser.
157 is a 40.
Yeah, so around 150 nanometers or longer than that. So you just don't have lasers that have periods that are longer, that are shorter rather than femtoseconds. And as a matter of fact, these five femtosecond lasers, these are all Phi Sapphire lasers, and they have a period of about 2.5 femtoseconds. And what I want to say to you is that represents a really hard limit for time duration using these lasers. You're not going to make a pulse that you can propagate as a solution of Maxwell's equations, undistorted, that has less than one oscillation in it. Really 1.5, maybe, something like that. So that really represents a hard limit, okay? And so these lasers, they have periods of, say, 2.5 femtoseconds, and they have energies of about 1.5 electron volts. So these are lasers that are able to drive the atomic motion in some system, and they're able to do this by putting excitation into the system, all right? What happens is you have some molecule and it absorbs a photon. The electron that absorbs that photon gets excited. That changes the potential that the atoms see, and they start to respond to that, all right? So you can study with these femtosecond lasers in chemical systems, you can study these systems via putting excitation into the system. Okay. Now we want to go to this attosecond regime, and this obviously requires that we're going to have a wavelength that is rather short. All right. The wavelength of these lasers is going to be in the XUV region. All right. So it's going to be something more on the order of 40 nanometers or shorter. All right. We're going to get 100 attosecond pulse, as you'll see, I'll show you in a little while. You need a central frequency, you need a bandwidth of about 19 eV or something like that. So these are going to be lasers that have central wavelengths that are well above the ionization, the first ionization potential of most atoms and most molecules. And this is really a constraint. If you talk about open questions or problems or whatever in this field, one of the big constraints is you are going to be initiating whatever process you're looking at via ionization. You're no longer, not usually at least, in the simplest implementation, be able to just put excitation into the system and watch it change. You're going to be ionizing the system. Okay. Well, just a quick word about, for the people in the other workshops, really attophysics sits in something called AMO science, atomic, molecular, and optical physics. And this is really a new kind of science that has emerged over the last few decades, really at the intersection of atomic physics, molecular physics, and optical physics. And it's loosely organized, if you could say, around the theme of influencing and studying small systems and hopefully larger systems with complex light fields. So that's really sort of the guiding principle. And it pulls people in from all sorts of fields. So people have come to attophysics and have come to this tremendously hard problem of making attosecond light pulses from a variety of fields and with a variety of motivations. If you had an attosecond experimentalist give this talk, I think almost certainly their motivation, their passion in this field would be for new light sources, making new light sources. The march towards ever shorter durations and shorter wavelengths, Gerard Moreau last week characterized that as a field with no limits, only horizons. And I think a lot of the experimentalists would tell you that their passion is really to make a new light source, a light source that's never been seen before. A lot of the theorists, like myself, have come to this from doing time-dependent quantum mechanics. And what we think is really cool is this is the dynamics behind the making of attosecond pulses is a fantastic time-dependent problem in quantum mechanics. So we've really been drawn into it by that. And in the application side of attosecond pulses, we really think it's a wonderful time-dependent source. It's really a new and interesting way to drive a quantum system that we haven't had before. So people come at it from different ways. They also come from different fields. There are atomic physicists. There are people from plasma physics. There are people coming from chemical dynamics. So really bringing all these different viewpoints together. So one of the most active areas in AMO physics is what's called strong field physics. Now, to tell you what strong field physics is, sort of, and what it has to do with this, it is the regime in which the interaction between light and matter is not linear, and it is the regime in which the interaction between light and matter is not perturbative, and I would argue that it's also the regime where things are not super strong. There was a time, back when I entered this field probably, when strong field physics had a very unambiguous meaning, and it meant whatever you were doing at the moment with the biggest laser you could get your hands on. So that's what was strong about it. It was just the biggest laser you had. That's no longer true, I would argue, all right? Because strong field physics has really settled out to have its own sort of place in the phase space of intensity and wavelength. And it's this regime where the interaction between atoms and light is not linear, not perturbative, but it's not super strong. So you have ionization-driven phenomena, but you are not to the point where the interaction between the laser and the matter is dominated by the laser field. In other words, you're in this very interesting regime where the interaction Hamiltonian is sort of equally strong with the binding Hamiltonian. Okay? So if you think about the linear case for the interaction of light and matter, well, in the linear case, a photon comes in and one of two things happen. Photon either scatters or an electron comes out. Now, in this linear case, an electron only comes out, as Einstein taught us, if the frequency of the light is high enough to ionize some electron in the material. All right, and scattering takes place at all frequencies. Well, with the invention of the laser, many happened, but for our purposes, the most important thing happened was that the intensity of the light source could get turned up. And when you turn up the intensity of light source, two things happen. The first thing that can happen, and these are sort of in historical order, is you can have harmonic generation, which is to say, you can have a process where two photons are absorbed and one photon comes out, which is now of twice the energy of the photons that were absorbed. Okay. Now, in a gas, for instance, this has been done for many years, you might absorb three photons and have one of three omega come out. Okay. Now, there are selection rules about this, and we'll always be talking about gases with inversion symmetry today, so all of the harmonic generation that goes on will be odd harmonics. The even harmonics are forbidden just by being able to shine the light in from either side and get the same answer. So that's the first thing that happened. And the second thing that happened is the realization that there could be multiphoton ionization. So we could start with the atom in some ground state, and we could take it to the continuum by having it absorb more than one photon. Now, both of these are processes that can be described perturbatively for a while. And when they're described perturbatively, they scale sort of as the intensity to the n power, where n is the number of photons that we're talking about absorbing. That's not really my point. There's one feature of this that you can already appreciate, and which is important for what we're going to do later. When you have a nonlinear process, the process is intrinsically shorter than the driving field. Yes? So, and you can think about this just from the fact that, you know, think about harmonic generation. You have to get two photons in the same place at the same time in order to drive the harmonic generation, and that's less probable than having just one photon around. So, whenever you have nonlinear processes, the duration is always shorter than the process that drives it, just because you have to get the photons bunched up in one place. And so they're usually shorter by a square root factor of square root of n in the perturbative limit. But anyway, nonlinear dynamics gives us intrinsically shorter pulses. Okay? So what we would like to do is to expose atoms and molecules to ever stronger fields and see what happens. That's strong field physics. Okay? To do that, you don't just need a laser with a lot of intensity. You also need a laser that has a very short pulse length. Okay? And the reason for this is because all ionization processes have some intensity-dependent rate associated with them. Okay? And if you wait long enough, the process will saturate. So after a while, whatever system you're looking at, the probability to have ionized will reach 1 and nothing else happens. So if the system reaches saturation before the peak of your pulse, it doesn't matter what that peak power is. The electron wasn't home to see it. Okay. This was referred to as the curse of Lambropoulos, and we are pleased to have Peter with us today. And this was really an important theoretical understanding in the field. It really helped push short pulse production forward. Now, there was, in the 1980s, a very important technological advance called chirp pulse amplification. I don't have time to tell you what that is, but it was a tremendous advance in how short pulses could be made. And now, with pulses that were shorter than 100 femtosecond, it became possible to have atoms experience peak intensities that were strong enough that we could get into new regimes of physics. And especially, we could get into a non-perturbative regime. All right. So now that brings up the question, what do theorists do in strong field physics? I'm a strong field physicist. What do I do, or what's our relationship to atophysics? All right. What we have to be able to describe, and the sort of problems that we do up to now, is we have to be able to describe a gas of atoms that is driven by a focused, high-intensity, very short pulse laser field, and which is driven to emit radiation, harmonic generation radiation, which is at wavelengths much shorter than the input radiation. Okay? That's the central problem that we have to describe. An atom exposed to a strong laser field. So we do that by solving the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. It's a non-perturbative system. So what people came to very early on was that we were going to have fundamentally non-perturbative methods for doing that. So the Schrodinger equation was solved, time-dependent Schrodinger equation solved essentially exactly for as many systems as we could to find out what are the dynamics of the electron, what are the time-dependent dynamics of the electron. Now, when you have that solution in hand, yes, so we can, that's a good question. So you have your gas, and you have all the atoms in your gas, and coming in is some sort of very focused laser beam, so that at some place in here, there's a high intensity and a short pulse, okay? The field is treated classically. So this is good. This is a good question. So you have a tremendous compression of the photons here, right? So for instance, a good border for when you can treat the field classically and not. We can argue a little bit about this, but a good border would be when you have one photon per cubic wavelength. Okay. For a very modest pulse, a 10 femtosecond, 1 millijoule pulse, you have, I think I calculated it somewhere, it's 10 to the 15 photons, something like that, in that pulse. And so you have about 10 to the 12th per cubic wavelength. So it's very classical field, very classical. Okay. So we have a classical field, but a quantum mechanical atom. We drive that, and we look at what happens. Now, we're in a regime. We're in a regime, this multi-photon regime, where we have to absorb many, many photons, if you will, or we have to absorb a lot of energy from the field in order to ionize. And what it turns out is the simplest thing that happens there is some valence electron, whose orbital is along the polarization direction of the field, will start to absorb energy from the field. Now, other electrons could also absorb energy from the field, but the most likely thing to happen is that the electron, which has already started to absorb energy from the field, continues to absorb energy from the field. That's the far and away most efficient process. So we get to what is effectively what's been called the single active electron approximation. Ionization processes in strong fields tend to be dominated by what are called sequential processes, where one electron absorbs a lot of energy from the field and ionizes, and then as the intensity rises further, maybe another electron can start to absorb a lot of energy from the field, but of course it's more tightly bound than the first one, and you pull that one out. So you really have this series of sequential events, and we can think of it in a one electron way. So that has worked, and I must say it has worked. It's the workhorse approximation of the field, and like any workhorse approximation, it works much better than you think it should. I mean, those are always the foundational approximations, the ones that work outrageously well. And that's certainly what we do. So we have a single electron problem for every atom. And what you get out of this is you get the time-dependent polarization of the single atom, and you get that by calculating the time-dependent dipole using the time-dependent wave function, which is the object that we're calculating. All right? This time-dependent dipole leads to a nonlinear polarization because this dipole depends on the field strength in a highly nonlinear way. That nonlinear polarization is a source term which you then have to put into Maxwell's equations to see how the emitted radiation propagates through the gas. All right? So, the idea is that we start in a ground state, we absorb a lot of energy, well above threshold, and we look at the emission of one much shorter wavelength, much higher energy photon. Okay? So, what comes out of this is a nonlinear polarization. We put that into something that solves the Maxwell wave equation to see how this radiation propagates through the gas, all right? Because this is, I want to emphasize, we're talking about a coherent process, all right? The radiation from all the different atoms is driven by the same thing, this fundamental field that's propagating through the gas, all right? And so this is good, right? If I had just one atom and it emitted radiation, that would be into a dipole pattern, right? And that's not very laser-like and that's not very useful. But in fact, all the atoms are emitting, being driven by the same laser, and so I have a coherent process. So when I add all that up, I get radiation which is proportional to the square of the number of atoms and which is very well collimated and in the forward direction. So although the light that we get out of this is not a laser, right, it's a parametric process, it's called, right, because it's driven by this. It is laser-like in the sense that it's coherent and you can point it at the wall and you can bounce it off mirrors and stuff like that. So it's very useful. Well, the tricky part of what theorists do in this field is, of course, this has to be fed back in to the original Schrodinger equation, and these two things have to be solved self-consistently as you go along, because as the atoms ionize, they change the refractive index of the gas, changes the laser pulse that's going through. Essentially, the simplest thing you can think of happening is you have a focused laser pulse then when it starts to drive ionization, that changes the index of refraction by adding electrons to the gas, which acts like a diverging lens. All right, so things get changed. Other interesting things happen as well. Okay. We want to make a short pulse. Okay. What's the problem?
You get a whole sequence of
yes. With twice that. Because of no even gas. That's right. So to appreciate what's going on, you have to appreciate what it takes to make a short pulse. Okay? So I have to talk about that next. Extremely inefficient. So, there's a lesson here, right? I have an extremely inefficient process. Why could that possibly be of interest? There are two ways in which it could be of interest. Number one is if I can drive it with an arbitrary number of input photons, right? In other words, if it's very inefficient, but it's powered by water, you know, seawater, then it's okay. And we have a lot, I mean, these optical photons are really cheap. So that's number one. The other time that you can get interest in a very inefficient process is if there's no other way to make that. 10 to the minus 6 would be a good number. A hopeful number. 10 to the minus 9 sometimes. The point is we do get measurable pulses out of it, and they're not yoctojoules. They're sort of nano, you know, picojoules, verging on nanojoules, and even a little higher. Well, what I want to talk about now, really, to see what is the challenge that atophysics has confronted up till now, and what really was the quest, is the idea of what really is it that you're doing when you're making a short pulse of light. So there's a short digression on short pulses. So, here's the, if I can draw this right, here's the electric field of one of these really short 5 femtosecond, 800 nanometer light pulses. Now these are the things that can be made intense, and that can drive the ionization, that can drive the strong field process. Okay? So, if you think about the electric field of one of these things, there's some envelope, which you see here, and then there's a time structure, there's a phase, omega 1 here is the central frequency, and then there's some time-dependent phase here, phi of t, that sits out there. All right, and in general, we have to know the envelope, the time-dependent envelope, and this time-dependent phase in order to characterize the light completely. All right, because you can change things a lot by changing those. If you think of this in Fourier space as a function of omega, you can write this as some envelope times some omega-dependent phase. And so you have two quantities that you can think about in this short pulse that are related to these two phases. You can think about what is the instantaneous frequency of the light, omega of t. And this will just be the central frequency minus the derivative of this phase. Okay? So if there is a time-dependent phase here, then the frequency of the light will change
as a function of time.
And the simplest sort of change is just a frequency chirp. All right? And so the frequency of the light will change. If the light is positively chirped, it means that the frequency is increasing as a function of time. If it's negatively chirped, it's decreasing as a function of time. The other way to think about this or to characterize it is by something a little harder to think about, is the group delay. And this is also a function of frequency, and it's just related to the frequency derivative of the frequency-dependent phase here, this capital phi of omega. And what this tells you roughly is, or actually not roughly, what this tells you is the time of arrival of the different frequency components. Okay? And these are, of course, related since they're just Fourier transforms. So to make a short pulse, what do you need? All right. The first thing you need is a large bandwidth. You need many frequencies. All right. And so, for instance, for a Gaussian pulse, the pulse width tau is just some constant 4 log 2 over the bandwidth. Okay? Now, this is the pulse duration of what is called a transform-limited pulse. Okay? Or a Fourier transform-limited pulse. Which is to say, this is a pulse that has a group delay of 0. There's no chirp, and all the frequencies arrive at the same time. Okay? Now, this is something that you cannot see from a spectral measurement. All right? The spectral measurement will only tell you the bandwidth that you have. All right? It doesn't tell you when the various frequency components in that bandwidth arrived. All right? And these things, you know, frequency chirps can lead to very large distortions of pulses. As a matter of fact, in the amplification of these pulses, there is a chirp put on the pulses before they are amplified of what? It's a factor of 1,000?
At least 1,000,
with no spectral distortion. So if you only measure this, if you only measure the spectrum of the pulse, and you were to calculate this pulse width, and it told you 10 femtoseconds, your actual pulse could be 1,000 or more times longer than that. All right? So without this phase information, you don't know anything. Okay? Now, there are ways to get this sort of information from autocorrelation measurements, taking the pulse, splitting it in two, trying to drive some nonlinear process with it, for instance. But that is not going to be available to us in the attosecond regime. So, with the TiSapphire lasers, you can get gain on a bandwidth of like 200 nanometers, which is to say there is a bandwidth that is, you know, verging on 20% of the central frequency of the laser. So it's a huge bandwidth. And it can be, through tricks, basically, all made to arrive in your target chamber at the same time with zero group delay. And that's how you get the shortest pulse. Now, there's always measurement problem here, right? And it's not the quantum measurement kind of problem. It's just a mundane measurement problem, but it really is sort of a paradox that you always have to work your way out of. You have the shortest pulse possible. How do you measure that? What do you use? Right? And so people have, over the years, devised for the optical lasers very clever methods to get around this measurement problem, and that's a whole wonderful talk that one could give. The short thing to say is they don't work in the attosecond regime. They don't work. Okay, so we had to do something else. But we will confront that measure. So that measurement problem was solved for the optical pulses, but it had to be resolved for in the attosecond domain. Okay.
Mm-hmm. they don't need to be constant, as long as TD is independent of frequency.
Sure. Sure. They all need to arrive. They all, I mean, there can't be any variation in that. But I mean, right now we've just been talking about the about making a femtosecond laser. So, but now we're going to talk about attosecond pulses. And for attosecond pulses, we won't be able to satisfy these requirements. So the attosecond pulses will not be transform limited. They'll be somewhat longer than their bandwidth would indicate. The question is, how much longer, and what can we do about it? Well, one more short digression and then we make the pulses. And this is really one more thing on how femtosecond pulses are made. Because this brings in also the Nobel Prize last year and what is the connection between that. In a femtosecond laser, there's a cavity where the amplification is going on. And in that cavity, there are an enormous number of longitudinal modes. And all of these longitudinal modes are extremely closely spaced. So if you look at the frequency spectrum, there's some overall envelope, which I'm approximating as a Gaussian here. So there's some overall envelope with the bandwidth we'll call capital delta omega. And then under this, there are gazillions of individual modes. How many, Phil? A million? Less than a million, but more than 15.
It's the ratio of the pulse width that you get out
to the spacing between the pulses. That's right.
So
we have a pulse, a spacing between these, which we'll call little delta omega. Okay. Now, if these modes are mode locked, which is to say they're coherent with each other, then what comes out of this, just by Fourier transforming, is a train of pulses. So in time, the output of this looks like, and now I'm drawing the intensity of the pulses, you get a train of pulses. The spacing here is 1 over delta little omega, and the time structure of the individual pulses is 1 over capital omega. Okay? And this spacing here in time, as Phil said, is just the round trip travel in the cavity. Okay? And
what
Ted Hensch and others, Jan Hall, learned to do was to stabilize this frequency comb and to use the precision of the spacing between these modes to do new high precision measurements. But what I want us to take away from this is a picture that's going to emerge from the atom as well. We have a frequency comb where if the modes are locked together, and I'll say more precisely what that is in a minute, what we get out of that in time is a series of pulses, and a series of pulses whose individual width is proportional to the total bandwidth, all right, and whose spacing is, of course, set by that spacing. So we've been making, as I said earlier, we've been making shorter pulses over the history of lasers the last 30, 40 years. Started out that lasers were driven by resonant processes. Those processes saturate at too low a power to give us high power lasers. So then non-resonant processes were explored, things where the index of refraction, the intensity-dependent index of the refraction of the material was used. And that has gotten us down to the femtosecond level. But anything shorter than that is going to have to be ionization driven. And so we're going to need more bandwidth than we can get out of these solid lasers. How much bandwidth? Well, if we just use this formula and we asked about 100 attosecond pulse, that would be a bandwidth of about 19 electron volts. So we need to go get an enormous bandwidth somewhere. And we're going to have a central frequency which is higher than this, right, so that we can have at least a single cycle and we'll have a pulse that will propagate. Okay. So what people started to do in the late 1980s, by accident, some people on purpose, but the main discovery was made accidentally. People started to do nonlinear optics in the strong field regime. So they started to look at this process of absorbing a lot of photons and emitting shorter wavelength photons in atoms that were driven non-perturbatively. Okay? And so what they started to do was take a gas of atoms, which usually come out of a jet, and to hit that with an intense focused laser and look at the light that comes out of it. So you have a lot of photons at some frequency omega 1, and you have stuff come out at 3 omega, 5 omega, 7 omega. Okay. So you start to look at the spectrum of the radiation that comes out. All right. And what does it look like? Well, you have something at the third harmonic and something else at the fifth. And so for a while, and this is a log scale, for a while you have this sort of exponentially decreasing yield. Decrease of the yield, which is what you expect. But after a while, it turned out that you got a very long plateau of harmonics that were spaced, again, by 2 omega here, and where the fall off was very slow. Okay. And this went out to some characteristic frequency, and then there was a cutoff. So you end up with this cartoon shape for the spectrum, which is actually very close to real. We have this sort of power law part. You have a long plateau, and then you have here at some characteristic frequency a cutoff. The cutoff? No. Much higher. Much higher. So this process, already by the early 1990s, had been driven to the point where the 150th or 151st harmonic had been observed. And by the late 1990s, over the 300th harmonic had been observed, I think, by the Gila group. So this is taking a lot of inexpensive 1.5 EV photons and turning them into 2, 3, 400 EV photons. So it's a very non-perturbative process. And we struggled for a while, maybe longer than a while, to figure out really what was the physics behind this process. Now, it's interesting. We were doing non-perturbative calculations, and the non-perturbative calculations gave us this form of the spectrum. So we knew that there was nothing too mysterious going on. It was just a one-electron process going on in a strong field. But it was a particularly difficult one to think about, because the question was, how did you get so much energy coherently into the dipole before the electron left? Right? You have to have an energy, you have to have some part of the electron wave function which has absorbed a lot of energy. Okay? And which is still coherent with some other part of the wave function which has remained in the ground state. Right? That's the only way to get a dipole with such a high frequency. You have to have population still in the ground state and something which is in the same region as the ground state, which has absorbed a lot of energy. Well, ionization processes, right, are really fast. Right? You absorb energy and you leave. Right? An electron that has 200, 300 EV of electron, what's it of energy? What's it doing hanging around to be coherent with the ground state? It's a real problem to think about that. Well, one thing that helped us out was that it was discovered that this cutoff obeyed a universal law with a better than usual meaning. Usually in physics when they say law, it means it's only kind of sort of true. But in this case, it holds very well. And it was found that this cutoff energy, well, there was the ionization potential of the atom, because after all, that you've put some part of the electron wave packet into the continuum, you have to get that back. but that there was also another scale here. This is called the ponderomotive energy. And the thing to say about the ponderomotive energy is it is an energy scale that applies to a free electron interacting with a laser field. If you put a free electron in a laser field, it will oscillate. The field will just drive it back and forth. And if you crank up the intensity of the laser field, it will drive the electron harder. Right? And so there is an energy scale that characterizes this process, and that's the average energy per cycle. And that's called the ponderomotive energy. All right? It's proportional to the intensity of the laser, and it's proportional to the wavelength squared. So long wavelength lasers have higher ponderomotive energies. And what it was found was this cutoff law obeyed a scaling where there was the ponderomotive energy, and then there was some number here, which is about 3.2, times the ponderomotive energy. So there was a bound piece, and there was essentially a piece that had to do with a free electron interacting with a field. And this can be a quite large number. The ponderomotive energy at 800 nanometers and 10 to the 14 watts per square centimeters, which is not a terribly high intensity, is about 6 electron volts. So 3 times that is 18, and then you use many times 10 to the 14, and you can start to see where you get all of this energy. So what's happening in harmonic generation? Well, and how do we explain this? And the explanation, we're kind of, this was one of those times when we were very fortunate in this field that we pull people in from all different directions. Because the explanation for this phenomena was offered independently and more or less at the same time by two different people working in the field from very different points of view. One was our speaker this afternoon, Paul Corkum, who came at this from a plasma physics perspective. And the other was a man named Ken Kulander at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, who was a time-dependent quantum chemist. So you had somebody coming at this problem from the point of view of plasma physics, thinking about ionized electrons more or less as classical particles being driven by a field, and you had somebody thinking about wave packets. That's how chemists think about ionization processes. Wave packets are created. And so the sort of standard model of harmonic generation and where this cutoff comes from disseminated very quickly because you could sort of pick your language. I think you would agree with this. There were people that liked one way and talking about it and the other. Now we all talk about it the same, but my observation from that time was this was a time when it was particularly helpful to have more than one person thinking about these things. So what's happening? Well, we have so many photons around. I mean, so many photons are being absorbed that the photon picture, right, this isn't useful at all. And we make a transformation to really a field-driven picture, where we think about what is the potential that the electron finds itself in. Well, there's the atomic potential, and then there's the electric field of the laser in the dipole approximation, which is very accurate at these wavelengths. There's just an electric field due to the laser. And so what you get as a function of time is a distortion of the Coulomb potential by this extra term. All right? So at various phases of the field, you'll go from having a potential that looks like this to a half a cycle later it looks like that, to then it looks like this again, and a half a cycle later it looks like that. And then the process repeats itself over and over again. And in this field-driven picture, ionization happens as a function of time. It's a very time-dependent, time-driven process. So that when the field is near its local maximum, the electron can tunnel out, and you get a wave packet here in the continuum. All right? This wave packet is separated by some amount that depends on the intensity, and it is from the ground state, and it has essentially zero velocity to begin with. Okay? So you have this process where every half cycle of the laser, you have a wave packet created in the continuum. Now, there's a very nice movie of this process, and I think, you know, I didn't want to interrupt the flow here by showing a computer movie, but we'll try and put it on the website with the talk so you can actually see these wave packets come out every half cycle. So now we come up with what? They spread, but they get driven by the field, and this is the important point. So we come up with, I don't know what you want to call it. What I'll call the recolliding wave packet model. And model is too weak a word. I mean, this is what happens. Okay, so what happens is that after the being ionized by tunneling, right, the field is down this way. Initially, the wave packet moves off in the direction it's being pushed and it starts to spread, but then the field turns around. And part of this wave packet is driven back towards the core of the atom. Now, while this is happening, it's also being accelerated by the electric field. So that when it comes back, and it comes back sort of when the field is close to the time when the field is zero, like this again, when it comes back, it has a lot of energy, and it can be coherent with the population still in the ground state. Now, this process is really extremely quantum mechanical, right? I mean, this is a Schrodinger cat working for you, right? Because you take the electron wave function, which is initially localized in one place in space, and you split it in two, right? You take part of it and you take it actually rather far away at decent intensities. This wave packet is sort of, you know, 20, 30 Bohr away from the atom, right? So we've got a piece here centered on the atom and a piece that's far away, and the field is doing work on that part, and then you bring them back together. And you get a coherence that leads to the emission of this radiation. Pretty cool. Not so many Schrodinger cats out there working and producing light in laboratory. No, I know Peter doesn't like this, but...
But you said this is tunneling.
It tunnels out, that's right.
It's a very fast...
Well, the barrier gets lowered.
The barrier gets lowered.
The barrier gets lowered.
Well, you're in a regime where the barrier is lowered a lot, and the wavelength of the light is long, so the period is long. But it's true. Now, the other thing to say is, there's no claim that this is the only ionization pathway, right? There's still multiphoton absorption going on too. But this is the pathway. Yes. True.
There's a differentiation. The sun will never move the atom.
That's right.
There is a decay, mm-hmm. and it is coherent.
Mm-hmm.
And if you reduce the intensity, then you don't get harmonics.
Then you don't get harmonics at all. That's right.
So there is a decay.
Right.
But typically, this is the amount ionized during one cycle has to be related to the pulse width, because you always...
That's right. Well, no, in Ferenc-Krauss's experiment, they're not at saturation at all. They're at sort of 16% ionization.
Okay, that's still at order of magnitude.
That's order of magnitude. So order of magnitude tunneling probability, 0.1% per cycle, something like that. What I'm saying is this is the pathway that leads to the coherence. I mean, that's the way Peter wants to talk about it too, and I fully agree with that.
But if you calculate what percentage of the wave packet is it? 0.1%?
0.1%, 1%, something like that, of the probability is in that wave packet on any given half cycle. That's right. You can think of it like that.
Okay, you can also do the process of the out-channeling by scattering, right? You can scatter the wave packet under the laser off some ion, and you will observe the same phenomenon. Just the...
It won't be coherent.
What?
If you don't... It's really important, and this is why I use that provocative language, it's really important that these two pieces are part of the same electron.
But it will be, because, I mean, you scatter your wave packet off an ion, and some part of the wave packet will get stuck on the ion, and next time you revisit, you're coherent, and then you get the combination. So it takes, you can observe that it takes like, you
that's
know,
right.
a quarter period.
That's right. Yes. You can order, that's right. You can start with an empty level and populate it.
Yeah.
That's true. It's very inefficient, though, in our calculations. I mean, we don't.
It's the same level conditions.
No, I don't see how that could be, because here we have 90% in the ground state. I mean, the numbers just don't work out. All right. Well, we have the explanation now. We understand where this coherence came from and how we could get so much energy into the excitation and still have it be coherent with the ground state, which I don't think it was said that way at the time, but I think that's a good way to phrase what the mystery was. Well, it's not amplification, you're just getting emission. Highly, highly stimulated emission.
By this calculation, you mean you're not solving the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, you're doing something.
Well, when you solve the time-dependent Schrodinger equation and you make a movie of it, you see this wave packet. Wave packet comes out over here, wave packet comes out over there, they come back. That's right. You can also apply semi-classical methods to that, and that's been the other big advance in the field, was that we could really clarify what are the quantum trajectories that contribute to this by doing semi-classical calculations. Well, it's an uncontrolled approximation as usual when you do this, right? But the parameter would really be the wavelength and the intensity of the light. So the parameter is usually called the Keldysh parameter, after a Russian physicist, and this is usually characterized this way. So it's basically the ratio of the tunneling frequency to the optical frequency. And so, but in energies, it's the ionization potential compared to twice the Ponder motive potential. And so at high intensity, this gets very big. Gamma gets very small. As gamma gets less than 1, the validity of this picture increases. So you want to be in this regime, gamma less than 1, to be really sure that it's right. But as I say, the tunneling part of the wave packet, even if it's not the main ionization channel, still drives this process. And see, so even though you could say, well, it's really valid in this limit, this cutoff law was discovered by looking at a huge number of numerical calculations over gamma much bigger than 1 and gamma less than 1. I mean, the scaling holds at a much larger range of intensities than you would think just from saying, I'm only going to deal with it in the regime where tunneling dominates the ionization. So that was very fortunate, actually, that we could see it down to those low intensities. Well, how much time do we... Are we getting there? Okay.
Well,
it didn't take very long, and for various people, and I'll just mention Steve Harris at Stanford, for several people to pose, well, look, here we've got an equally spaced frequency cone, and by analogy, this analogy here, what we should get out of this, if we just can select this some part of the spectrum, is we'll get a train of very, very short pulses, because this is an enormous bandwidth, okay? And we only have to combine, I don't know, 11 harmonics or so to get below 200 attoseconds for the individual pulses. It turned out to be much more complicated than that, but eventually the problem was solved. The problem is the following. When this wave packet propagates and returns, all right, you can think of this wave packet, because the density of state is very high, you can think of it just composed of quantum trajectories, and you can calculate, let's say, the dipole moment that contributes to the Qth harmonic, you can calculate this as a sum over quantum trajectories, and you'll have some sort of strength and you'll have a phase. And this phase will be given essentially by the classical action for the electron just going out, being driven by the field, and coming back. Well, as usually happens in quantum mechanics, for most of the energies that you consider, especially the energies in the plateau, there's more than one trajectory that leads to the final, same final energy. And you get interference between these things. The different paths are the difference between an electron that leaves at one at a time when the field is low and spends a long time being accelerated in the field, and an electron that leaves when the field is high and spends a shorter time. So there are, in general, more than one way to make any harmonic. And these pathways interfere at the single atom level. And so if you think about this as being a pulse, these harmonics in the frequency comb don't seem to be phase locked. And so when I mentioned Steve Harris only because I can admit to being one of the people who told Steve about this interfering trajectories and that his idea wouldn't work. And he found that rather persuasive, I must say. It turns out that although there is an interference in time, right, the harmonics, of course, are made in time and space. They have a distribution in space. And what saves you here is the distribution in space, the divergence of the wave fronts corresponding to the emission by the two different pathways are very different. One of those pathways leads to light which has a very small divergence and goes essentially forward. One leads to pathways that have a very divergent curved wave front, and those diverge very quickly. And so by filtering spatially the light, you can actually get an attosecond pulse train out of this. And that's what was done in 2001 in the group by the group in Paris. And then later on, Strauss's group learned how to take radiation just from out here at the cutoff. Now, near the cutoff, there are not these two ways. There's only one way. It's like any coalescence that you have in a semi-classical process. There's only one time when that light can be made, and they learned how to select that light and make single attosecond pulses as well. Okay. What kind of applications? Let's just talk about applications for a minute. What are we going to do, right? We have these. What are sort of the tools that we're going to have? And you're going to see in the talk later today what are the tools that we have in hand right now for doing attophysics? Okay. The first one is the recolliding wave packet itself, because this is an object which is made, propagates, and comes back over a little longer than an optical cycle. So it is an object that is made, propagates, comes back sort of over a femtosecond. All right? And we have this intrinsic frequency chirp, which is to say the different harmonics are made at different times. Okay? And so this wave packet can actually be used to get timing information on things that are going on in your atom or molecule on even a sub-femtosecond time scale, because you can look at what the sort of processes that this recolliding wave packet encounters when it comes back. All right? Another thing is, of course, you have trains of attosecond pulses, and then you have single attosecond pulses. So these trains, the individual pulses in the trains, are down at the level of about 130 attoseconds. Before this week, I would have said that the single attosecond pulses are at a level of about 250 attoseconds, but now we have confirmation from the Milano group of something essentially at this. And both of these experiments, the ones that produce these individual pulses, these train of pulses, and the individual pulses, both of them are pushing to get below 100 attoseconds later this year. So we will see that either later this year or early next year. Somebody will break the 100 attosecond barrier. So these are the tools. What can we do with these tools? Well, in a time-dependent way. These recolliding wave packets can be looked at, can be used to look at dynamics, and that's Dr. Corkum's talk on Wednesday. So you'll see a lot of that. These attisecond pulse trains can be used. For instance, to do a very interesting kind of interferometry between electron wave packets. And the single attisecond pulses can be used to do pump probe experiments where the initiation step, though, it should always be said, the attisecond pulse is always starting things off by doing ionization. Right. So what I'd like to do right at the end here is to describe one particular one particular application that that the group in Lund has done, and they've made a very novel interferometer. And they've done this by having an atom. The atom is sitting in a background infrared field. And here is the vector potential of the infrared field. And now the interferometry, it's easiest to think of this as two-pulse interferometry. They had more than two pulses in their experiment, but that's just a complication. They did a kind of two-pulse interferometry, which was very interesting. They had two attisecond pulses, which were a half cycle of this infrared laser apart, and which were much shorter than the cycle time. So they could essentially take some portion of the electron and lift it into the continuum at a time of their choosing, and then a half a cycle later, they would do this again. And they would observe the interference between these two electron wave packets in momentum space. Okay? So what they finally observe is as a function of final momentum, here's a cut through the three-dimensional momentum distribution, they observed an interference pattern due to the fact that you have these two times when the electron could go into the continuum. Now, what's interesting about this interferometer is when the electron comes into the continuum, it's not free. It actually finds itself in this infrared field. Okay? And depending on when it enters the infrared field, it can receive momentum from the field or not. Right? Basically, depending on when it enters the field, the momentum kick it gets is sort of the charge times the field at the time when it enters it. Okay? So there's two kinds of modes in which you can operate this interferometer. The first is where you have the two pulses come at places where the where the infrared field vector potential is zero, and so there is no momentum transfer. And what happens in this case is the fringe pattern that you see in this momentum distribution, the fringe pattern is governed by the phase that is accumulated by the electron between the first time it can go into the continuum and the second part. All right? And that phase depends essentially just on the area under this curve. Okay? And so what you end up with is you end up with an interference pattern that depends on the amplitude of the field. Okay? Now, you can do the interferometry at another time. You can have the pulses come at a time when the vector potential is maximum. In this case, The first electron receives a momentum kick in one direction. The second electron receives a momentum kick in the other direction. Long story short, as they say in the Northeast. Now, because the integrated area under the curve is zero, there's no effect on the interference pattern from the amplitude of the field. And now the interference pattern is given by the difference in the dipole phase, the dipole phase will have a real part and a so-called dipole phase, right, which is something which is characteristic of the electron in the orbit that it's come out of, and it will be the difference between the dipole phase at two different momenta, right, because you've kicked one up and one down, so you have two momentum distributions that have been distorted, and where they are now made to artificially overlap, right, this is called a momentum shear. So the momentum distributions are made artificially to overlap, you will see an effect of this dipole phase. Now, what's cool about this interferometer is usually interferometers work in one of two modes. So here's my drawing of an interferometer. Some light comes in, and here's a mirror that splits it in half. And then we have mirrors that bring it back together. So here's path one, here's path two, here's where we do the observation. Usually, you do one of two things. You use an interferometer that you understand really well, that's well characterized, and then you measure something about the light, like its wavelength or coherence or something like that. Or you use light that you understand really well and you measure something about your interferometer. This is how LIGO works in my limited understanding, right? This is an interferometer that operates in either mode, right? In the first mode I talked about, you find out something about the arms of the interferometer, right? Because you find out something about the field. And that's obviously what's doing the work. In the second mode, you find out something about the electron wave packets, number one and two, that you sent here. And you can imagine that there's a third mode you could operate this in, where you do something to the atom in between these two pulses. And so that's like putting something in one of the arms of the interferometer and imaging it. Okay, well, I think I've gone over time. There's a lot more application type stuff that I could talk about, but I think we'll leave it there.
Since we